Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. Taking you inside the sport of kings. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back, hour two, about 5 minutes in. Thanks to Mike Trombetta and to Kevin Kirstein getting us going in hour one, and Rich Migliori standing by. Good morning.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Little quasi. I can't call it a vacation for me, but it's a vacation for Tina, and I'm sort of I'm the beneficiary.
Well, listen, I've been where you are. I don't know if you want to divulge any locations, because you might get stalked something. But
No, everybody knows I'm here.
Yeah, so, like, you know, with the kids when they were younger, Carmella's aunt and uncle had a condo down there. And, you know, the boys really loved it. Gabby loved it. We went into, like, those different shops, and they allegedly sell coins from sunken treasures over there and stuff. I mean, they loved that when they were little, so we got plenty of those.
I love it. I'm a freak when it comes to the shells. I love shells, and I love being at the beach and finding, you know, kind of a treasure hunt. And Tina, you know, when she came back from here, and it's pretty famous. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I'd find them when we're on the East Coast of Florida, but not, this is crazy. I mean, they just,
you get those pristine shells over there because you don't have the waves crashing, breaking them up. It's beautiful. That's my favorite part of Florida.
I had never really been south of Bradenton, essentially. Not much further south than Tampa. One thing I didn't mention, and we'll talk to, I don't know if we'll talk to Tommy today or tomorrow, but of course the sale starts in Ocala. I did stop, we did swing through Ocala. I wanted Tina, to see OBS and to see the World Equestrian Center, which I had gushed over with, you know, to her. So we did swing through, you know, we were going right by Ocala anyway, and I went and looked at half a dozen, New York breds. For the sale too, so I made it a useful trip. Yeah,
very good. Well, you know, my son Joe's been down there the whole time, and so if you have any questions, just ring him up. He's been down there for over a week now, at least.
A week, sure.
More.
Yeah. Well, they started the Breed Show last Sunday, and now it's been inspections the weekend, and they'll start sending them through the ring tomorrow, 4 days worth, and we'll talk to Tommy Ventura and get going for, you know, really the big, this is sort of the big box opportunity, 1,200 horses starting tomorrow through Friday. And, of course, Gary Young on site. We talked to Gary last week after Taba's win. So the sale will be tracking it all week. I should also mention, of course, you know, you heard from Jim Lawson the other day for Woodbine's opening Saturday and Sunday. Tomorrow, of course, Indiana gets going, Horseshoe Indianapolis. And we're going to talk to Jim Watkins, too, because FanDuel, it's very hard to say FanDuel Racing and whatever, casino, it's Fairmont Park, but it's, you know, FanDuel has branded it, and so FanDuel/Fairmont Park opens tomorrow as well. So we'll talk to Jim Watkins down there, as we have the last couple of years, ahead of their season. So it's a, you know, it's a kind of a transitional week, and Keeneland, of course, week two, and on Saturday, Rich, in particular, you guys were tracking the action, and the cross country slapped together with Aqueduct. Some thoughts about the weekend?
No, yeah, good racing. We had good weather the on Saturday. You know, it was a little breezy, but beautiful, and nothing's really changed for me Derby picture wise, you know, out of the Lexington or anything. You know, it's, you know, congratulations to those connections, but I just don't see it being, you know, a very important Derby prep. What I saw in the Wood Memorial, what I saw in the Bluegrass, what I saw in the Louisiana Derby has my mind very well set. I have my top three.
Well, you want to expand? Is it too early
okay,
for that?
Listen, I think Epicenter, the other dimension he's shown in the Louisiana Derby, sitting in the pocket as comfortably as he did, waiting for Joel Rosario to ask him the question. He elevated so much in my eyes. And just when we talk about that, horses getting good at the right time, maturing at the right time, he just checks every box for me. Zandon, a horse that can, negotiate his way through a field the way he did, wend his way, and I think he got a very good trip. Some people, I think, had a different take on it, but he created his trip. He was able to make the spots when he needed to. He's, very lithe on his feet. He can kind of get to a spot and idle and then, pick it up and get to another spot. I mean, he's got those ballet moves in him. And I just saw a lot of maturity from Mo Donegal, a horse that always, as a two-year-old, looked like he was running with the emergency brake on, stops and starts. I didn't see a lot of change from him physically, but mentally different. Carrying Joel Rosario into his hand, didn't need to be demanded of, which as a two-year-old, if you weren't kind of, pedaling, he wasn't running like one of those typical bicycle horses. I saw a different horse, so those three, they're all, to me, very, very capable of getting the mile and a quarter. They both, all three, just act like they're getting good at the right time, and horses that help their riders, horses that, aren't going to get keen, are going to wait on their riders' cues, and Mo Donegal, long sustained runs, Zandon, ability to make a couple of different kind of runs, and then, of course, Epicenter, just a horse that, is going to put himself in a forward position, should get a good trip in a big field.
An interesting topic came up inadvertently with Kevin Kirstein in the first hour, Rich, and we were going through the field, and I noted Ray Luca Gutierrez and Ramon Vasquez in particular. You also are going to have guys like Lemaire and Barcelona that are I don't want to say wild cards, but we have had international riders come over and be involved in Derby, but for the more familiar rank and file journeyman like a Gutierrez and a Vasquez, this is a big opportunity, and it occurred to me to let you riff on what it's like when you don't have the Derby experience of those that have won. I mean, you've obviously got the Rosarios and the Johnny V's and so forth that are going to line up, but Mike Smith, etc. And even guys that haven't won it but have had plenty of experience. Talk about the here you are, 18 days, 19 days, whatever it is, out, and the anticipation and the nerves involved, and what it's like knowing that you're going to ride in the Derby.
Well, it's funny. I can only speak from my personal experience. I was 20 when I went to ride the Derby for the first time on a horse coming off of wins in the Gotham and the Wood Memorial, and more. I was just really excited for that opportunity. Growing up in New York, in where I grew up, you were aware of the Derby, but it wasn't as much on your radar as, let's say, a Toboggan Handicap or, even the Wood Memorial was like a dream come true to win it. It might as well have been Mars to me. Louisville, Kentucky was not a place I had ever, been to as a kid. It's not like, I could really even equate it to anything. I started watching the Derby in earnest with Honest Pleasure. I obviously I saw Secretariat, I was aware of it, but Honest Pleasure's Derby with Bolt Forbes, I was a big Honest Pleasure fan. A dear friend of mine, Carlos Figueroa, was a Bolt Forbes fan. I was a Baeza fan, he was a Cordero fan, so we had these heated debates as a kid, and then of course Bull Forbes won the Derby and came back to win the Belmont. But so for me, when I got there, I was riding a lot for Mark Cassie, a very young Mark Cassie. He put me on several horses on the undercard, and I remember being in the room, and I couldn't understand why I wasn't nervous. I just didn't feel nervous. It just felt like, you know, that excitement level. It was cool to be there. I was on a horse that was coming off two big wins, but also I kind of knew was a little wrung out by then. He had broken his maiden in February, came back like 10 days later, won an allowance race, came back a few weeks later, got dusted by Pancho Villa in the Bayshore. He didn't make the lead, and he needed to lead my horse. And then, of course, he was facing Spendabuck in that Derby, who set very fast fractions, and, you know, just ran everybody off their feet. But and then he won the Bayshore, I mean, the Gotham in the Wood, you know, within the next month. And then I went to Louisville to work him the week before, and he was such a good workhorse, and he really worked poorly. And so I don't know if it was maybe I kind of knew underneath that he had already had his campaign and was over the top by then, and you know, I didn't feel like he had a legitimate chance. Maybe that's why I wasn't nervous, or I don't know. I just, it's weird. I remember thinking that, like, wow, I should have butterflies or something. And maybe because Mark was kind enough to put me on so many horses early, I was busy most of the day. But you know what? Listen, 20 horses make the gate every year for the Derby. Back then it was less. Usually I think that was like a 15 horse field of the year, the first time I rode in it. But every year now 20 horses are going to run. So there's only 20 jockeys in the whole country out of what I would say 1,200, you know, active jockeys. There's more that are licensed, but, you know, people that ride on a regular basis. So out of that gene pool, you're one of 20 people that has thought enough to ride in America's race. I mean, so it is a big deal. And it shows other trainers, other owners, connections, that people have confidence in you to send you there. And it leads to other opportunities, you know, and then if you have success in it, of course, you know, that's going to be something that's going to really propel you. But just to get the honor of being involved and being a part of it is a big deal. Listen, I liked Relu Gutierrez from when I saw him as an apprentice. He's got an infectious personality. He works hard. He was in Maryland. I tried to get him to come up to New York at that point, and I thought he was going to go with my brother Michael, which I thought would have been a great fit because, you know, one thing I've instilled in my brother, and certainly my son grew up with it, as an agent, take care of your rider. Like, you know, I always felt good when I had an agent that was worried about me, that was like felt like we were a team. Not guys just throwing you on horses to get mount money. And when you're an apprentice, you need your agent out there with you. You know, this what's become vogue, Steve, is guys being in other states and having riders, you know, far flung all over the country. That might work with established journeymen. With an apprentice, you need that guy in the trenches with you. You know, you have a bad day and you're leaving the races. You need to be on the phone with that guy, or at least walk out with him and talk about what happened and, you know, if you made a mistake, how to rectify it and what to do. And I think Relu made a big mistake, you know, not giving my brother the opportunity. My brother took Dylan, and you've seen what they've been able to do, and it was a process. Not having that guidance. A young rider needs guidance. So now he's gone, you know, traveled, he's riding the Midwest, and people have seen his talent, and he's matured and steadily improved. And that's what you want to see from a young rider. There are young riders that start out gangbusters, and they don't improve. The ones that consistently are taking steps forward, and you see how their thought process, you see how they're thinking about a race, how you know, they've made a mistake, but they don't make that mistake again, and they keep improving the game. Those are the kids that make it. Those are the kids that are truly race riders. There's a big difference between being a jockey and a race rider. Jockey has a license. Hey, I'm a jockey. Race rider has dedicated himself to the craft of it. And I see Relu as a race rider now, somebody that is thoughtful in his approach, looks at it, thinks about it, and he's really settled in. Jose Santos Jr. has done a great job with him, and you can see he has a lot of support from bigger-name trainers in the Midwest.
looking at Gutierrez, it'll be his first ride. Ramon Vasquez, it's actually his second. He rode in 05 as well. And so it's been a bit of a break. And, I mean, I find him very, very accomplished. I think he's a good rider. He rode Mr. Z, actually, in his only Derby try.
Was that for Steve?
13th.
Yeah. I think he's a good rider. Listen, the colony at Oakland Park this winter was very deep. And one thing, you know, you see different circuits, there's almost different styles. Like New York guys tend to be more patient, less pace on. I don't know, like I can't quite put my finger on it because speed is always dangerous. And I have theories about all that kind of stuff. One is I don't think in general young riders develop the clock in their head that we once did. And obviously notable exceptions. I'm not lumping everybody in this. But so I think guys are a little bit less comfortable on the lead because they're not quite sure if they're going an 8th and 12 or an 8th and 11. And you've got to know that. You know. And not only do you have to develop that clock, then you have to keep that clock tuned. And I think trainers make a big mistake trying to micromanage everything with, you know, headsets in the morning and, you know, well, you just went the 8th and 13, you went, oh, slow down, speed up, you know, to me, it's like, come on, well, this is NASCAR, you're dealing with a live animal, you gotta feel a rhythm, learn a rhythm, and I think trainers make a mistake because it inhibits a rider from developing that clock and having it tuned for the afternoon and where you can't use a headset, so you know, at some point you have to let go a little bit of the process and say, well, I trust this guy. I remember one day I came to the barn and John Kimmel pulled out a headset and I took my helmet off and I handed him my helmet. He said, what's this? They said, why don't you work yours yourself? I mean, if you're not going to trust me to do my job, you know, then what am I doing here? You know, and I never believed in it. I still don't. I mean, you know, but you know, I'm old, so I can say these things now. As a kid, you know, we didn't have that technology. You learn to do it right, or you got a boot in your butt. Maybe walk horses for a few days to think about it, and then you know, got a chance to do it again. You did it right, you know. So, you know, that's one of the things I think that like riders in New York get a little bit uncomfortable. Some of them go into the lead; they're just not quite sure. And then we talk about this all the time. I just, there's an art to riding a speed horse. There's an art to riding a front runner. And it's not simply jumping to the lead and going as slow as possible. You have to allow your horse to use their stride to their advantage and basically get everybody else off the bridle chasing you at some point. If you've established that advantage, use it at some stage and start spreading the field. One of the greatest underrated rides in history, maybe not, but to me, I never thought it got the praise it deserved, was Steve Cawthon on Slip Anchor when he won his first English Derby. He got very comfortable, great rhythm, came down off the Tatton Corner, and he opened his hands and started letting them march on, and all of a sudden, everybody that was traveling in the bridle behind him is off the bridle chasing. And, you know, they didn't really see that in England before. And it was risky, because then if you open up 5-6 lengths and get caught, you're going to be open to a lot of criticism. But that's how you become great, and that's how you ride a speed horse. There's the art in it, like taking advantage of a horse's natural weapon. So you're getting back on track here. At Oaklawn, guys are not bashful about letting horses bounce. Very rarely you see a false pace at Oaklawn Park, and watching Ramon Vasquez, he's strong. He's a position rider. He gets his position going forward. There's a lot to like. And I guess he's going to California. That's correct, right?
Yeah. Yep.
He will sure do is. Extremely well there. As long as he works in the morning, and you know, I would imagine he's got a good work ethic. I don't know him personally, but, you know, to have the success he's having, you'd have to think that he puts in the time in the morning. If he has a work ethic to match his ability, he will do extremely well in California.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, a smart a smart career move for him. You know, and I'm just looking, the minute you said, I'm looking down at your Derby mounts, and we talked, last week when I brought it up with Andy Beyer, in fact, what Randy Moss had talked about, the Derby pace scenarios that have become really kind of stunted because we just don't get horses like Bob Blackjack.
Yeah, Bob Blackjack. That's a pretty good story. And so Jim Kasparov trained the horse, and I speak my mind. I'm not going to hide anything at this point. But I rode him in the Santa Anita Derby, and he got away with a very soft pace and didn't stay the mile and an eighth under ideal circumstances. He got run down, and it might have been Colonel John. And they asked me my opinion in the tunnel at Santa Anita. What do I think about the Derby? And I said, if you want my honest opinion, no. He, you know, mile and a quarter, too fast a pace for the distance. I just don't see him ever getting a mile and a quarter, particularly in a bulky field with pace, you know. And I went home, and my agent called me and said, listen, they're going to run Bob Blackjack in the Derby. And I said, well, okay, you know, listen, we're just second in the Santa Anita Derby on a horse. I've, you know, you don't want to not go. It, you know, it's almost embarrassing if you go, right? And he said, yeah, but you're off the horse. They don't think you have confidence in him. I said, well, they asked me for an honest opinion. I gave it. You know, you want me to lie to you? So the next morning I went to Jim Kasparov's barn, and I told him I had a dream that I won the Derby on Bob Blackjack, which was a lie. And he put me back on the horse. He called the owner, woke him up the next morning, and Mig had a dream. And I rode him. And then when he was stopping and I was getting bounced around the far turn, I was like, I should have stayed home. But so I got fired telling the truth, and I got the mount back lying. So.
Well, you have to know, and certainly there's been speed horses that have stayed on, and you know, you think about Hard Spun. Not that he was a speed horse per se, you know, he was just a good horse, but you know, you look at maybe like a Bodemeister, you know, who was traveling nicely and you know, got corralled, obviously, but you know, had. If you know going in, Rich, when you're sitting in the gate and you know that it's unlikely that you're gonna be able to make it all the way around, but you know where he's gonna be. I mean, what's the mindset?
Well, you know, I will say this: one thing that I didn't get the first Derby because it was a mile and a quarter, and I'm thinking, well, a mile and a quarter, you know, it's a route. It's not, you know, but in the Derby, you got to come out running. You have to come out running, get your position going forward. I unfortunately got left, you know, with Eternal Prince, but that was more a function of when they said, you know, the last horse was loading in, the infield crowd was erupting, and he had never seen an infield crowd before, and he was turning himself sideways and got off poorly, which happens every year in the Derby. And then I actually was very disappointed because Joe Hirsch wrote a book about the Derby and wrote that, like, I was nervous and tight as a string. And I, like I stated a little earlier, I couldn't understand why I wasn't more nervous. But Joe Hirsch had never seen me that day. We never even spoke. So I don't know how he came up with this idea of that. And I went to him when this thing came out and I was like, how did you characterize me this way? How did you portray me this way? And he was, oh, somebody told me. I said, somebody told you? And I was so disappointed, and I expressed that to him in a gentlemanly fashion. I didn't lose my head or anything. And he said, oh, you know, I'll make it up to you. I never got it made up to me, never clarified for the record what it was. And I was always disappointed in that. Now, how about this for Peter Krolovich, if I'm saying his name properly, he's his first cousin, lives up here in Millbrook. And Jay Hovde introduced us, and the other day I went, he's got really a couple hundred acres, just about 2 miles from me, and we've, like, really hit it off, and we go on these hikes through his property that he's got, you know, all these paths carved out, and he took me up in his attic, and he has so much memorabilia and stuff from Joe, notebooks with his notes and pictures, and he insisted I take a couple of these incredible prints. Like, you know, he was friendly with Bill Hartack. I got this amazing thing with Bill Hartack here. Got a picture with Piggott and Shoemaker. So it's just crazy that you wind up meeting people that you have a connection to somehow, even though you didn't know them. But I'm very thankful to Jay Hovde for introducing us, because he's become a good friend. And, Steve Miller, the Steve Miller Band, his property's next door, so the paths go through his property, and he's all into that as well. So it's just a funny, you know, how you wind up in these situations.
Well, and I remember you telling me that once as well about about that with Joe. The I heard, you know, on a similar front, and I think I heard it. Yeah, I heard it over. Was it over the weekend? Just about Mike Smith's experience on Palace Malice, and how he just couldn't control him. He just was a runoff at that point with the blinkers added. And, sometimes it's not.
Too, it was a sloppy track that day. It was sealed. And when horses run on a sealed track, you hear the noise when they come by you. I mean, it is thundering hooves. And you get a horse with blinkers, and you've kicked out of there because, again, that's pretty much what you have to do in the Derby is to establish some position so you don't get shuffled back. Now he can't see, but he hears all this, you know, pounding hoofs around him, and he just ran off. I mean, it had to be a bad feeling for Mike, you know, but then they took the blinkers off and they won the Belmont Stakes. So, unfortunately, it was the Derby that taught them how the horse needed to be handled, right?
Yeah, exactly. I also appreciate the Derby side of things. I also mentioned earlier this morning, I was so pleased that Regal Glory won again, and another, gets the Grade One Jenny Wiley on Saturday, and how bittersweet her success is with Paul Pompagon. But I thought it was notable. I did think it was notable about the way in which Jose Ortiz just basically rode her like she could not lose, and sometimes that can be dangerous, and you can get yourself in trouble. Of course, it's a shortish field, but I mean that feeling has got to be, second to none. Getting aboard and knowing you're on the best horse, and you can in this case ride her like she's not losing.
Oh, when you know you're on the goods. I remember riding Tensky in the Queen Elizabeth there at Keeneland. Just felt like there's absolutely no way she could lose, and just kind of, riding her with that almost disdainful confidence, like, nobody's got a chance. And I got to ride Jersey Girl in New York Stallion Stakes. She was a Jersey bred, but she was by a New York Stallion, belonged to me. And she was literally like 20 cents to the dollar. And years ago, I had seen Jacinto Vasquez ride a really good filly. I think it was for Tommy Root, the Mangurians. And huge favorite, broke out of the gate. He broke out of the gate, and he sat on her back for three or four strides. And she won easily, and I came back, and I asked him about it. I was a kid, and he said, the only way she could have lost is if I fell off. He said, so even if she stumbled, I was going to keep my seat the first couple of steps. I wasn't, because your inclination is they break, boom, and you raise up off the saddle and you're going forward, and if they stumble, that's when you go over their head. So it always stuck out in me. I had never done it. And then I rode Jersey Girl, who was, multiple Grade One winner. I rode against New York breds and Stallion Stakes race. They were like half the field was maidens. And I did that. I just remembered what Jacinto had done that day, and I said, well, the only way this filly can lose is if I fall off, so I just got to make sure that, even if she stumbles, I don't come off or something. And, after the three jumps, she was off. She won by eight with her ears up and, with her head bowed. It's rare you ride one that's that much the best, but pretty cool when you do.
I don't want to pick on Tyler Gaffalione here, but were you on the air for the fifth race on Saturday at Keeneland?
I was not, no.
Did you see that with credit event? He basically, you know, the full field, you know, going a mile and a 16th, and you know, short price, etc. In fact, how short? I don't even remember how short. I wasn't disappointed that Limited Liability won $1.70. Basically, put credit event in a completely compromised situation, and you know, no one says you gotta sit four wide all the way around, and because that, you know, that can be a formula for disaster too. But you also can't be on the best horse, seemingly on the best horse, and have yourself in a position where you're adding to the challenge level.
Well, I think, you know, again, that's knowing what you're on, and sometimes you have to drive a bit defensively. You have to, you know, basically take care not to get in a compromising position because you are best. And you know, listen, Tyler's a terrific young rider, but he, you know what, he's still a kid. You know, he's still, you know, as accomplished as he is, I you know, those are things that I think you have to, you know, figure out over time that, hey, I'm on the best horse. I got to ride him like the best horse. But, yeah, I mean, you got to drive defensively a little bit when you're on, you know, much the best. Just give your horse the opportunity to run, even if you have to lose ground. But, again, that's just knowing what you're on, knowing, you know, just that I really can't lose this race unless I make a mistake, unless I do something. But, you know, it's a dual-edged sword, too, Steve. One of the things that made Jerry Bailey as great as Jerry Bailey was is Jerry took edges on the best horse at times because, you know, the thought process being they're not always bringing their A game. You don't know that, like, today this horse might not be as good as he normally is, and you're riding him like he's much the best, and then he comes up lacking, where if you had cut a corner or two, you might have won. But Jerry, you know, listen, I rode privileged to ride with so many brilliant, great riders. Jerry, to me, was, you know, obviously in that list of great riders, but his prime lasted longer than any top rider I had ever been around. He was in his best form for such an elongated period of time, you know, and part of it was his approach. He was, you know, he really took care of himself and methodical at how he did things, and he was fortunate to go a very long period of time without being hurt. But that being said, you watch some of the rides he gave short price horses and cutting a corner here and there. People talk about his ride on the horse that won the Breeders' Cup that paid a huge price. Breeders' Cup Classic. You know what I'm talking about, for Andre Fobb? I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on this. At Santa Anita. Yeah, Arkang, right? I've heard people say, that's the greatest ride of all time. I see it different. It was a great ride. But when you ride a horse that's a huge price, it gives you the luxury of saying, well, I'm going to take my shot and stay down in here. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. I mean, he's, you know, 99-1 anyway, right? So as brilliant as it was, there wasn't the pressure involved with riding, you know, an 8-5 shot that way.
That's a great point.
Shot that way,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Not going to be as open to that criticism that we're talking about. That being said, though, some of the rides for Jerry give horses that were, you know, I have memories of Silver comes to mind, even Cigar at different times, where he took an edge on the best horse. That takes nerves of steel. You know, it absolutely does. So, you know, there's two sides to that coin. You know, I'm critical of riders when I feel like they didn't prepare and they didn't have a plan. I don't want to be as critical. I agree with you. Sometimes, though, you have to have an understanding that, hey, I'm on the best, and the only way I can get beat is if I do something to compromise my horse's trip.
Well, and when it comes to any critique, I suppose part of it is the proximity, riders that, you know, have a real proximity to, you know, to horse players and owners and fans, you know, you're right there amongst, you know, particularly at, you know, a place like Saratoga, for instance. There shouldn't be the sensitivity to critiques. I mean, jocks ride in some cases 7-8 times a day. And so how is it any different than, you know, a quarterback throwing 37 passes or a running back carrying the ball 19 times? not every athlete is going to make, you know, the perfect choice. You know, pitcher throwing, 85 pitches, you're going to make mistakes and you're going to get criticized. And then when you throw a shutout with 14 strikeouts, you're you're going to get the praise heaped on you. I mean, stop with the sensitivity, you know. Don't be so sensitive to the critiques. I mean, anytime Andy says anything about a ride, you know, guys, you got jocks following him, unfollowing him, getting angry. And it's like, stop.
That gets very silly. That gets very silly. You know, listen, it's a great point. I would love to be able to tell you that I wasn't sensitive at times during my career. I can't say that. There were times that, you know, I felt like, you know, really, you're criticizing me, and it's weak. I can recognize it now because I'm not immersed in it. When you say, well, how many horses did you ride? It's a weak argument. It no doubt. You know, but that being said, yeah, there were times in my career I wish I had handled things a little better. You know, also, fold this into the equation. In New York, at one period of time, you had the Daily News writing a synopsis of the day's races every day. You had the New York Post synopsis of the races every day. The Newsday synopsis races. And you would go to get your coffee in the morning, and a guy, you know, that works the coffee shop would be like, oh, Mig, what happened in the third race? I say, John Pison wrote this, and, you know, Ed Comerford wrote this in the Newsday. Like, so you're aware or conscious of that constant scrutiny, where some guys did much better when they would ride in a circuit that didn't have as much press coverage. Like, I wish they covered the races the way they did then, now. Like, you know, we had that kind of interest. But some guys succumb to that pressure of, you know, oh, wow, you know, when I go pick up my paper, the guy just criticized me because John Pison wrote something about my ride, and my coffee guy said this, and it's just so funny. I mean, I think I told you one week about going out to the block party on my street in Floral Park. I didn't want to go out to the block party, but I had children. My wife's like, you got to, you know, for the kids, go out, mingle with the neighbors. And I had ridden at Belmont that day, and I was riding at Meadowlands that night. And I said, you know, so I can't eat, I can't drink, I go out, and these guys have, you know, they've already run off half the afternoon drinking beer or whatever and talking with them, being polite, being a good neighbor. And one guy says, hey, you know, what happened in the third race on Wednesday? You got, you know, checked, you stopped, and, you know. And I politely asked what he did for a living. He's a plumber. I said, would you appreciate if I was standing over your shoulder when you were fixing a toilet, telling you what you did wrong, what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong? Like, and everybody laughed, and the guy got mad at me. But, you know, you're in a different mindset when you're immersed in that every day. Listen, I told you this. I've said 100 things about a guy. Good. Criticize them once, and that's when you hear from them. It's, you know, you're a professional athlete. You're on the public stage. You know, it's all transparent. It's apparent. There it is. And again, I don't criticize for split-second decisions that didn't go properly. I criticize when a guy makes a mistake because he was passive, became a victim because he didn't have a plan, where someone else did and they executed it. When they are clearly buying a horse that bears out and they make the decision to go around that horse, when you know he bears out, if you're doing your homework, you know he bears out, or not handicapping other riders properly. You know the guys who are going to guard the fence with their life, which not as much now, but, you know, in the 80s and 90s in New York, you know, you didn't want anybody getting through on you. Now, everybody's a little bit looser. Or the guy who was going to pack you out if you made the first run. You knew if you went to Chris Antley first at the quarter pole, he was going to his left hand and packing you to the sixth path. So let this guy make the first run. Let him get packed out. I'll cut the corner. You know, things like that. You have to know habits of horses, habits of jockeys. That's when you're really doing your job. It's not as simple as, well, I read the form, and this is speed, that's speed. How many races I won on the inner track when speed was so dominant, Steve? All right, there's three speed horses in the race. I'm one of the speeds. Let's go watch replays now. All right, that horse is fast, but his first three steps aren't fast. This horse, he's in front after an eighth of a mile, but he doesn't have real gate speed. Come out, take it away from them, because they didn't even realize their horses didn't have what I, you know, deem gate speed, as opposed to, yeah, they're fast horses, but their first two or three steps weren't as quick as mine. I get the drop on them. And then once you've established that position, guys will tend to go, okay, all right, well, I'll follow now. Now I've got control of the race. All these little things that add up. And again, it's the difference between being a jockey and being a race rider. Riding wasn't a job to me. It was an absolute way of life. And anybody that's done it at a high level or you know, has had success doing it, it's because they dedicate themselves to the craft. There's horses that are going to win no matter who rides them. The guys that I always was inspired by were the guys that won on horses that, man, I don't think anybody else would have won on that horse on this day.
Yeah, well said. Right, right. No, that's perfectly framed, Rich.
Yep. So, anyway, did I run off again?
That's great. No, it's tremendous. Tremendous. Wesley Ward's going to join us next. You rode against Wesley.
Yeah, Wesley had the bug 84, 85, I think. I had the bug in 81. Wesley could ride. You know, and then, obviously he was killing himself to make weight, but Wesley could really ride. His grandfather, Outrider Jim Daly, legend in New York. Me and Willie Belmonte, Eddie Belmonte's son, as kids didn't like each other. You know, we both were going to be jockeys. I'd come out and get on the pony for Carlos Garcia. He would get on the pony for Frank Martin. One day we were jawing at each other on the training track, and we went up to the quarter pole and turned around and breezed these ponies trying to beat each other, like race riding. And Wesley's grandfather, Mr. Daly, grabbed me, and we got ruled off. We weren't allowed to get on ponies for like 6 months. And he pulled me on the side and, like, you know, just read me to riot act, like, you know, you've got a future in this game, and you want to, you know, be a hot dog and do this stuff. You want to blow it before you. So, like, really put me in my place, and I felt so bad, and I had so much respect for the man that all I could do was apologize. And I remember I had, like, tears in my eyes, like, because I knew I disappointed him, you know, and acted like a dope, you know. But yeah, I mean, we both were convinced that, like, I'm going to be a better rider than you, and we just didn't like each other. Later on in life, we became friends, but as kids, man, I think a couple knockdown dragouts behind the track kitchen.
Oh, I love it! I love it. Well, Rich, I appreciate it. We'll talk next week. I'll be at Churchill, and we'll be in under the Derby watch, under the Derby fortnight. But you seem locked in, unless something goes haywire.
Yeah, unless something really changes. But I don't, those are my three. You know, I might figure out some other ways to play exotics and use bigger prices somewhere. But I those three, to me, they just check every box as far as what I look for. And I'm looking forward. I'm excited about it. Enjoy the rest of your working vacation. By the way, last night we pulled up from Easter Sunday dinner at my sister-in-law's. The freaking black bear was in my garbage. Carmella had made, you know, for the kids, she had made a bunch of cupcakes. And she burned the first batch because she got sidetracked because she was rolling brajol and stuff, you know, to bring with us. And I threw the cupcakes, and the bear was enjoying the cupcakes, the burnt cupcakes.
I love it. I love it. We have similar trouble, but it's only with raccoons. So I'll leave the bigger furry creatures to you.
I hollered at him. He kind of looked at me like, let me finish.
Exactly. You're interrupting me. It was you had your Easter, I'm having mine.
Steve, I'll talk to you.
I love it. Thanks a lot. MiG 4450, everybody. There you go. You know what? We're close enough, actually, to the top of the hour, and we can maybe let Casey, maybe you want to break here, and we'll come back. We got Wesley Ward and more, so we'll talk about hour three. When we get back, coming to you from Sanibel Island, I got no complaints being here. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning. Learn more at countrylifefarm.com.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Four brand new races to be run at Parks for PA-sired, PA-bred two-year-olds. There are two $100,000 contests on August 22nd, PA Day of the Races. September 24th, PA Derby Day, has two more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series. Yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine, shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a